Stem Cell Exchanges. Your insight into stem cells from leading scientists.
An embryonic stem cell is essentially gives rise to every cell in the body. So every single one of us was an embryonic stem cell at some point.
I think we all are interested in embryos in the first place, because as soon as you can understand that you start off as a little thing and then you get bigger, then you start to wonder, well, where did you come from in the first place?
Welcome to Exchanges at the Stem Cell Institute with Mariana Alves in collaboration with Pint of Science. The Cambridge Stem Cell Institute is a world-leading center for stem cell research based at the University of Cambridge. Our mission is to transform the prevention, diagnosis, and treatment of disease through a deep understanding of how stem cells work. We have 29 research groups with over 300 scientists spanning basic to translational research. You'll be hearing more from some of them in this podcast series. This week, we are talking with Cédric Guévat, Senior Lecturer in Transfusion Medicine in the Department of Hematology and Consultant Hematologist of NHS Blood Transplant.
I will start by asking you what platelets are and why they are so important to produce in vitro and why we need them.
So platelets are small blood cells that circulate in the blood, and their main function is to stop bleeding. And that happens, for example, if you bang yourself or cut yourself or if you have an accident or indeed during surgery. So if a blood vessel is cut open or damaged, what platelets will do, they will detect the damage and they will stick to the damaged blood vessel and stick to each other. So they'll form a great big plug, and that plug will stop and stem the hemorrhage of blood through the damaged blood vessel. So if you don't have enough platelets, you will simply ending up bleeding and bleeding to death.
And how frequent are platelet disorders?
So platelet disorders inherited from your mum and dad are actually quite uncommon. They're a rare disease. What is, however, common is that through treatment, we actually reduce the number of platelets in the blood of our patients. And that is particularly true for cancer therapy. So if you receive chemotherapy, for example, very commonly the blood platelet count will decrease to such level that the patients are actually at risk of bleeding. And these are the patients we give blood transfusion to. The other group of patients that have a very low platelet count are patients that are either injured and have a large trauma because they have to clot so many blood vessels, they consume their platelets. And that's also very true for surgery. And if you have very extensive surgery, such as cardiovascular surgery, for example, your platelet count is very likely to decrease because you need to clot so much. And for both these group of patients, what we do is to give them blood transfusion. Blood transfusion come in two forms, either red cells or platelets. And every year to patients who got a low platelet count, we give 280,000 pools of platelets.
That's a lot of cost. And it all comes from donors.
And all the platelets that we give to our patients come indeed from voluntary donations. So these are blood donors who come in the blood donation centers or the mobile units and give a unit of blood. And from the unit of blood, we can make both red cells and platelets. And there are a group of blood donors that give only platelets, and they come to specific blood centers, and they are literally connected to a machine that will harvest only their platelets.
Okay. And is there a shortage of platelets or red blood cells from the banks?
So in this country and most advanced Western countries, there is no platelet shortage. Mm-hmm. We have enough platelets to give at any time point. However, the management of stocks of platelets is very difficult,
yeah.
More difficult than most other blood cells, simply because platelets cannot be kept in the fridge.
Mm-hmm.
They have to be kept at room temperature, which means that we can only keep them on the shelf for 7 days. Now, if you imagine a long bank holiday weekend, a Christmas break, when people are much less likely to walk into a blood donor center, for example, around Christmas, it's not uncommon to have 4 days where everything is shut,
yeah.
Then there's a 4 days lag to absorb into a 7 days shelf life, which we can absorb. But these are critical points where we have to manage the stock very carefully. it's of course not the case for developing countries, and particularly countries that have got a lot of endemic infection, HIV, hepatitis B, malaria. All these germs and bugs can be transferred through blood transfusion. So that makes the harvesting of safe blood a lot more difficult.
Yeah, and how do the platelets sense that they need to act? What are the signals?
So what platelets have on their surface is a series of receptors. You can describe them a bit as like antennae of insects. And what those receptors do, they detect the base membrane of your blood vessels. And usually that base membrane is not exposed, it's covered and it's well protected because your blood vessel is intact. In case you have an injury or the surgeons need to, for example, remove a tumor, that base membrane of the blood vessel will get exposed. And the platelets will sense that with their antennae. And when they make contact with that base membrane, A, they will stick to it, so they will adhere. They will also become activated. And when they become activated, first of all, they give a signal to all the other platelets that are passing by saying, you need to come here. And they will link to each other. And they basically form a great big chain of platelets that turns into a plug that will block the blood vessel.
And when you say that people that have, if they don't get a transfusion, they will just bleed to death. So the only way of really stopping a bleed is with
A platelet transfusion, okay. That's right. Yeah. At the moment, we have no alternative to platelet transfusion. If your platelet count is very low, the only way to stop bleeding is to by bringing the platelet count up, and that is through a platelet transfusion.
So your lab is interested in the production of platelets in vitro, right?
Yes.
And how are you doing that?
So we're working with a certain type of stem cells called pluripotent stem cells, and these are like our base material. And the advantage of pluripotent stem cell is that you can maintain them for a very long time in culture, and you can stock them. And from those pluripotent stem cell, we tell them to become the platelet mother cells. Now, that has got a very complicated name. It's called a megakaryocyte. Mm-hmm. And it's literally the cell that in yours and my bone marrow release platelets every day of our lives. So we need to make that mother cells from the stem cell. And we do this by changing the identity of the stem cell with key switches. We basically turn on certain lights within the cell that tells that cell to become a megakaryocyte, not to be a stem cell anymore, to just change identity and to become a megakaryocyte.
Are these chemical switches or also other?
So the way a cell decides to be a liver cell or a lung cell or indeed a megakaryocyte is by making a load of very specific called proteins. And proteins are basically the machinery that makes your factory work. And the proteins are decided by your DNA code. And your DNA code will get the proteins to all of the cells. It'll encode your protein to all of the cells. What happens when the cells become one cell or the other, it only chooses to make certain protein. So what we do, the switches are simply little sequence, little protein that will tell that particular cell you need to make the proteins that make you a megakaryocyte. So they're not chemicals, they're proteins.
Okay. And you also use engineering to give these cells a scaffold to mimic the bone marrow.
That's right.
Environment. And why is it so important to have the environmental cues there?
So your megakaryocyte, the platelet mother cell, will release 1,000 platelets. Each megakaryocyte gives rise to 1,000 platelets. And the reason why it's so efficient is because they have all the machinery to really disaggregate in 1,000 platelets. But of course you want to do that at a specific time when the megakaryocyte is ready. And the megakaryocyte receive cues from the bone marrow to do so. And the cues are the blood flow, because they release the platelets only within the blood vessel, but also the contact with other cells. And indeed, the support they get within the bone marrow itself. And the absence of all these clues, the release of platelets from megakaryocyte is very inefficient. you get 1 to 10 platelets per megakaryocyte, so way less than what's in the bone marrow. So the way we've addressed this is by building a structure, a three-dimensional structure, that gives some support to the megakaryocytes themselves. And then we decorate that structure with the right message that makes the environment look like the bone marrow. So there's megakaryocytes that are supported, and also what they see around them looks very much like the bone marrow. And it makes them a lot more efficient at releasing the platelets. And we've seen a gain of about 50 times by just doing so.
Okay. And is it very challenging to use that 3D structure? Is it very inefficient to do it in a large scale for in future production of these platelets?
So that's one of the key challenge of any production of cell in a laboratory. How do we make it efficient and economically viable? So the base material for the scaffold, for example, we've chosen is collagen. Now, collagen is extremely common. We all have a lot of collagen. It really is one of the support structure of the whole body. You find it in the bone, you find it in a blood vessel, you find it in a muscle, you find it everywhere. So we've chosen a fairly cheap base material, and it's also very versatile. You can make a lot of very different shaped 3D structures out of collagen. So it's the versatility and the fact that actually we can get it reasonably cheaply that has driven us to do that. The actual process of making the collagen scaffold has been in existence for quite some time, and we've used collagen scaffold, for example, to make implants, to generate bone, or to generate meniscus, so the little piece in the knee that makes your knee move properly. And we're applying the same technology but simply to a different field. Whether it's translatable to large scale or not, that is something we're currently exploring, so that we can make this an economically viable venture. But we started with this base material very much with this in mind, that it has to be able to translate into a large scale production.
And what other challenges do you have in that project that you want to address in the future?
The challenges is always to transfer a discovery that you've made in the lab, the bench, into a process to generate cells that are actually safe for human use. We have to use chemicals that are a lot more defined, a lot more quality control, and we have to do it on a much larger scale. And a simple transfer from one recipe, for want of a better word, how to make the megakaryocyte and the platelets in the lab, to the other recipe, which is how to make it at large scale and safely for human use, that's a very big challenge. Okay. And that requires a considerable amount of work and even more considerable amount of money investment. And that's really at the stage where we are at now, that translation from the discovery to the use in clinic.
And do you feel like there is a lot of support for scientists to do that transition, or you feel it's quite hard to do that?
Currently, I think the UK is one of the leading countries in the world doing this, and there is indeed an awful lot of investment and support, both from investment from the government into this area, as well as charity. In terms of developing cellular therapy. So I think we're certainly the country that is leading on that. And I think people have become aware of how difficult that technology can be if we want to apply it and benefit the NHS ultimately. So yes, the support is there and the awareness is there.
And if a person has a genetic disorder, can you also couple the platelet production or in the case of maybe this is more applied to red blood cells, I'm not sure. Can you couple that with gene therapy of those cells?
So that's an interesting question. There are certainly countries where the technology of stem cells to make blood cells is applied on a personal basis. So one makes the pluripotent stem cell or base material from one individual, and then we make the blood cells for that individual particular use. It's very attractive because that means you don't have a risk that the platelets are not a match, for example. but it's also extremely costly and very difficult. I think it is a potential application, and I think very specific application for very specific patients. But in terms of the large-scale production of platelets, I don't think that's an affordable way to do it. But yes, people are applying the same sort of technology and forcing cellular identity into the stem cell to correct patient's defect.
And you also have other projects more focused on therapies for specific diseases, and you're working in a phase one clinical trial, or going to, is that right?
So, that's right. So we also looking at a production of red cell in vitro. So the red cells are basically the cells in the blood that carry the oxygen. So when you breathe in the oxygen, what carries it to your muscles and all the rest of your organs are your red cells. And there are patients who lack red cells, so that these patients are anemic. And you can be anemic because, again, your bone marrow doesn't work, for example, if you've got cancer. Or you can be anemic because you've inherited some red cell disorders from your parents. And the only way to, again, address this issue is by giving red cell transfusion. So the NHS Blood and Transplant, which is partly funding my research, has a program of research to not only make platelets, but also the red cells. And there's a group in Bristol that has developed the technology to make red cells in the lab. And indeed, we are now at the exact time point where we want to check whether those red cells work well. And therefore, we've got a trial starting later this year in Cambridge, where we're going to inject a very small quantity of those red cells we make in the lab into healthy volunteer and check whether the red cells that we make in the lab last in the circulation just as well as the donor blood cells.
And is it easy to find the healthy volunteers for those kinds of trials, or is it still hard? People don't have a hard time trusting clinical trials?
I've been overwhelmed with past clinical trials by how willing people are to take part and realize, you know, that their effort is part of a very big picture. How easy it will be to recruit for the red cell trial, I can't tell you that. So yeah. At the moment, we are literally right now asking that question of a set of potential recipients, and we're going to ask them, if the trial was to take place, would you be willing to take part? So we are currently in that sort of feasibility phase to see whether we can recruit for the clinical trial. But in the past, I have been very pleasantly surprised. People really pay attention. They read in the newspapers, they are very well informed. A lot of people go on the internet to find these things out and do realize how crucial these can be, and are therefore quite willing to participate in clinical trials.
And which message would you give to people who are still not very familiar and maybe are a bit scared of these clinical trials and trying new scientific.
So the clinical trials we're talking about are cellular therapies. And cellular therapies are now emerging for an awful lot of disorders. There are cellular therapies for neurological disorders such as Parkinson's disease. There are cellular therapies for eye disease. And now we're getting to the point of cellular therapies for the blood cells. I think my message is that we as scientists are really aiming to make things work, and therefore I think whatever loophole you are afraid of, we are similarly afraid of, and we close those loopholes in the lab well before we even think of having a clinical trial. And let's not forget that we are all extremely scrutinized by the regulatory agencies and by ethical committees. To carry out a clinical trial, I will have to obtain ethical approval. And this is basically going in front of a committee and saying, this is the clinical trial that I would like to carry out. Do you agree it's ethical to recruit human volunteers to the trial? And we get very much scrutinized in small details about whether it's ethical or not. And the regulatory body is the MHRA. Mm-hmm. And the MHRA will similarly scrutinize what we want to do. And the main remit of the MHRA is to judge that our cellular therapies are safe and what we propose to do is safe.
And What kind of, you have different therapy approaches for different diseases. Can you talk a bit about the different diseases you're trying to address therapeutically in your lab?
Also disease modeling? So the in terms of the disease we're addressing are disease of blood cell production.
Yes.
So the platelet transfusion for people with low platelet count and the red cell transfusion for people who are anemic. So in terms of the platelet transfusion, as I said, I think the vast majority of those platelet transfusion will end up benefiting people who are either have cancer, mm-hmm. and the most common that affects platelets are leukemias. Leukemias, cancer of the blood, are the one that really require an awful lot of platelets. And of course, then the rest of the patients are undergoing surgery, who are very sick, for example, on intensive care units. These patients very frequently require platelets. In terms of the red cells, the vast quantity of the red cells that, again, we consume are red cells that are given to cancer patients who've had surgery. And then, of course, there are patients who have inherited disorders. And the most common inherited disorders where the patients benefit from transfusion are called thalassemias or sickle cell disease. Now, sickle cell disease is a disease where the red cells tend to agglutinate together. And one way to treat it is by giving a red cell transfusion. And the patient's red cells and the donor red cells mixed together tend to agglutinate a lot less. In thalassemia, literally the red cells that we produce are simply not there. We don't produce them at all. And these are patients who receive blood transfusions throughout their lives. So every 2 to 3 weeks, these patients will come to a hospital and receive 1, 2, or 3 bags of blood. The advantage, obviously, of giving them the manufactured red cells is that when we make them in the lab, all those red cells are extremely young. They're very freshly released, as it were. So they will last in the circulation longer, which means we could space out the interval between transfusion for those patients.
That would be very good. And you also use the red blood cells or the megakaryocytes to model disease and learn more about the diseases
That's
themselves,
true.
Right?
So platelets have got another nasty edge to them. 1 in 2 people will die because their platelets will clot in the wrong blood vessel. So they will either clot in the arteries of the heart, that's a heart attack, or will clot in the arteries leading to the head, and that's a stroke. And that really is the most common cause of death in Western societies, is basically your platelet blocking the wrong blood vessel. So understanding how platelets truly work, so that we can really target the platelets so that they don't clot in the wrong place, is key. It's absolutely crucial. So indeed, in the lab, in my lab and an awful lot of other labs, we are studying our platelets function. The advantage of the technology that we've developed is that we can change the proteins inside the platelets by manipulating the stem cell we start with. So this is called disease modeling. You can change a gene in your stem cell so that you get a different type of platelets. And that will tell you exactly how that gene functions. And knowing how the gene functions will tell you whether actually this is potentially a target to stop the platelets clotting.
And are you able to see, for example, in patients that had strokes but survived, can you study their platelets? Or because it happens so localized, it won't be a general platelet effect?
Yeah, that's one of the problems, is that the platelets are not the only player mm-hmm. in the cardiovascular disease.
Yeah.
Of course, cholesterol, we've all heard about that, will an increased cholesterol level will lead to damage to the blood vessel in the heart, for example, or in the head. And therefore, the platelets will stick to that damaged part and
yeah.
create the clot, and therefore the heart attack or the stroke. So the platelets are not the only player
mm-hmm.
in a very complex disease. But we certainly can provide some answers for at least one of the players in the complex disease. Now, relating to your questions, are platelets of one patient more or less the same to the other patient? Well, does one patient survive and the other does not? We've done those studies, and there are clearly patients that have got more reactive platelets than others. And we only now really are seeing understanding what are the drivers that make one platelet more reactive than the other. And of course, the idea is that one day, if we know what those drivers are, can we test for that and then have personal therapy? And therefore, patients who've got platelets that are very reactive, would they benefit for having more medications to stop the clot in the heart compared to the other group, where the platelets are a bit less reactive? And it's only now that we're starting to do what we call stratified medicine, where actually the patient's own personality, for want of a better word, in terms of its biology, in terms of the way its platelets react, will influence what we do in terms of treatment.
And the blood cells are always renewing themselves. So,
that's right.
Megakaryocytes are being produced
all the time.
So can they start functioning differently after some difference in the bone marrow or in the environment, or would it always be consistent?
No, that's not true. It's a very plastic system. Mm-hmm. So it adapts all the time. So for example, if you've had a bleed, for example, your bone marrow will know that you've lost red cells and platelets and will therefore get stimulated, mm-hmm. and produce more of those. So it senses its environment. People who've got a chronic inflammation, such as patients with arthritis, for example, they have a higher platelet count because the inflammation creates a signal that tells the bone marrow to produce more platelets. Mm-hmm. And that's a very interesting question. Are platelets different depending on whether someone smokes or someone's has eaten a lot of fatty food? Is something that we are only just scratching the surface of for the moment.
But you're also looking at that.
Yes, there are groups, mm-hmm. certainly in Cambridge, that are looking at that. The mm-hmm. environment might decide whether your cells function in one way or the other.
You started by studying platelet disorders in neonatal.
That's right.
Right? So can you tell us a bit about that?
Yes, I can. So when a mother is pregnant, she doesn't necessarily have the same blood group as the baby that she carries, because the baby would have inherited its blood group from both mum and dad. So they might be different. And in the vast majority of the time, mum will tolerate that and will not do anything. But sometimes the immune system of the pregnant mum will mount a response against the blood group that's carried by her unborn baby. And when that happens, the blood cells of the babies can be destroyed by the young immune system. And that's, for example, the case for the group rhesus. So if a baby is rhesus positive and mum is rhesus negative, some women will become immunized against their babies, and that baby will become very anemic because the red cells that carry the rhesus blood group will be destroyed. And the same can happen to platelets, and in which case the baby will have very low platelet count, and that can be potentially catastrophic. Some of those babies will die before being born because they will bleed massively in the brain, or they will die just at the time of birth, or have a big bleed in the head and be disabled as they grow up, cerebral palsy, for example, as they grow up. So the problem we addressed was whether we could give an agent that would block the mum's immune response so that the platelet of the baby is not destroyed as quickly as possible. And we've demonstrated that actually the agent we developed is able to actually slow down the process, and the cells are not destroyed as quickly. And that will make a whole difference to the baby. The platelet count might still be low, but not so low that it would be a very high risk of bleeding.
Was it at that point that you started being interested in hematological research, or was that from the start of your medicine career?
I've always been interested to have an academic career, mm-hmm. And I trained in hematology before I started my PhD. But whilst I was training in hematology as a registrar, I had an interest in platelet transfusion and bleeding. Having that background, I think that helped me find a post to do my PhD in that particular field.
And how easy it was as an MD to adapt to the research? Or was it a rough start? Or
I think never ask a biomedical scientist what it's like to have a medic in the lab. I think immediately the eyebrows are raised and the alarm system starts sounding. I don't think it's easy. I don't think it's easy because scientific approach to a problem is very much, it's a specific knowledge. And that I had to learn through my PhD. And indeed, it was my first postdoctoral position. I was still learning how to do science properly. And that's not a given. There is a very different approach to a medical problem and a scientific problem. The advantage of being an MD is knowing what the potential applications are and seeing a little bit how the translation of something in the lab can work to then make a therapy for humans and clinical trials. But it is a learning curve. I don't think that any good medic could make a good academic medic.
And what would you tell potential junior doctors or MD students that are still deciding on whether to try research?
To have an academic career or
yes.
not? I have a project in the lab. During your training, take an interest into what's going on in research in your institution. Ask for time off or dedicate some time to join a laboratory and see whether you actually enjoy it. Life in science is hard. You have to attract the grants, you have to write the papers, you have to take rejections, and if more than 50% of your experiment work, you must be cheating, so a lot of things don't work. You really need to experience it firsthand to decide whether that's the career for you. And it's not a given. And I think there is nothing that can teach you what it's like until you actually walk in the lab and do it.
What are for you the biggest challenges for the next 5 or 10 years in one, hematological research, and second, in general clinical research?
In terms of hematology, I'm not a hematological malignancy person.
Mm-hmm.
It is really a field that has got its own expertise, which I have not got. So if I speak of the more the transfusion side,
yes.
I think providing safe blood supply, including to third world countries, that really is one of the major challenges in modern medicine. Yes, we can provide blood products safely in the West, and we have enough of them. But clearly, there are challenges to address there. We need to make them safe. Every new virus that we discover, we need to make sure that we can't transmit it through blood transfusion. We've heard of what happened with hepatitis B, with HIV. We had the whole issue of variant CJD. We now have the issue of hepatitis E, Zika virus, of course, in South America. So making the blood supply safe throughout the ages is always going to be about finding the next solution. And I think, in part, the solution is to make the cells in the lab. And the next challenge, I think, is to really find funding to do those clinical trials and really translate what we now have in terms of technology in the lab into a large-scale production that's applicable to patients. The big challenges in medicine in general, that's a very broad question. I think that's one that you should have as a discussion with a pint in front of you. Some people will argue that cancer therapy has not really changed over the last 30 years and the results are not good. Some will argue that actually the emerging resistance to antibiotics is a real concern for the human race, and I would certainly argue that that is one real big area of research where actually it's at the moment not entirely recognized and underfunded. But clearly I think there are still very basic medical problems to address, such as basic nutrition to some parts of the world, basic sanitation to part of the world. We take it for granted, but millions of people die every year because they have access to no food, no clean water, and that in itself is a medical challenge.
You talked before about the challenge of translating into a large scale mechanisms. You also have a partnership with a company, right? Yes. Novosang.
That's right.
So what is that company doing, and how? What is the relationship between, because the trials and commercialization are different things.
So the company you mentioned actually is not a company. Novosang is a consortium of scientists and based primarily in Scotland with partnership in Bristol and in Cambridge. So the Novosang is a consortium of scientists that have got one drive to one day derive red cells in the lab that are safe to use in humans. Mm-hmm. So that's a consortium of scientists. But with the platelet work, yes, there I've got a partnership with a company called Platelet Biogenesis. And my experience so far of dealing with the company is entirely positive because they provide a level of expertise and an understanding of business and investment that is necessary to develop the cellular therapy on the really, truly large scale. And I think the relationship between scientists and companies is the only way forward if we really want to translate our discoveries into something that is useful on a very large scale. I think it depends on what the ethos of the company is. If the ethos of the company is first and foremost to deliver a therapy, then you're on the winner. And of course, they'll have to be economically viable, and yes, there will have to be profits. But that doesn't change the ethos. If the ethos is to deliver a therapeutic agent, or indeed cellular therapy that is safe to patients, then it is the way forward.
I was wondering, as a medic, maybe the contact you would have with patients can give you a lot of feedback. So maybe you don't need as much as public contact as other scientists.
That's not true. I think that the your patients is what drives you. And certainly there are moments when I'm on call and we're trying to find a blood compatible with someone who has got such a rare blood group that there is no blood available because there aren't donors available. It really brings home how important it would be to have a supply of cells that we can make in the lab that would be compatible with those patients. When we did the research with the babies who have this bleeding disorder, we reached a certain milestones. We published the first clinical trial that we did. And actually on that occasion, we invited a patient group that had a special interest in that. Mostly mothers who've experienced how traumatic it can be to have a baby affected by this disease. And they came to the blood center. And basically the evening was about presenting the research to all the partners that had made it happen, but including the patients to whom it might benefit. And it gives you an immense drive to make it happen, to realize actually how relevant your research is. And that really is very important. Recently I had a phone call from a hospital in London, and they had a newborn baby who had an extremely low platelet count, likely because mum was immunized, but baby was quite well. But we know that it is in the first 24 hours of their life that these babies will actually bleed. And I recommended the clinician to order the special platelets that we keep on the shelf for that particular condition to treat this baby. And after that phone call, I realized how lucky we are to be in a position to be able to offer these blood products. And it's quite sobering to realize that actually even in Western countries, there are places where we can't do that. And this is really one disease where actually speed is of the essence and giving the right platelets is of the essence. And it brings home how far we still have to go. And that drives you. And it's just, I mean, I'm a father myself, and one of my little one ended up in intensive care when they were born. And it makes you realize how being on the receiving end of such an event is very difficult, very emotionally difficult. And being able to provide something to parents who have seen a baby like that, I think that's that really brings home why I'm getting up and going to work and writing the next grant application.
That's definitely a good driver. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this week's Stem Cell Exchange. To hear all our future episodes, subscribe to our podcasts. We will also be having an event in Cambridge in June where we showcase artworks inspired by the research of all the scientists we interview. For more information, go to stemcells.cam.ac.uk. We would like to thank our collaborators, Pint of Science, and the Stem Cell Institute Public Engagement Seed Fund and its funders, the Medical Research Council and Wellcome Trusts, for supporting this podcast. Have a great day.